Well, those are the first few minutes of Anton Bruckner's sprawling Ninth Symphony, the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Sir Simon Rattle. He's been standing in front of them on a box for the last 16 years, and he's just stepped down. He's off to the London Symphony Orchestra. While he was in Berlin, he took this fine orchestra and turned it into something slightly different, not so traditional, an orchestra that played a lot of new music and also involved itself heavily in education. In fact, there's an interesting article just this week in The Guardian about how Simon Rattle has been conducting orchestras of amateurs in the Berlin Philharmonic Hall. We'll put a link to that on our website. Anyway, to mark the occasion of his retirement from Berlin, we thought we'd listen to an interview which I did with Rattle in 2015 when he was in Australia with the Australian World Orchestra. We talk about the role of the orchestra today, what it should be playing, and the power of Bruckner's cathedrals of sound.
He's one of the greatest symphonists that ever lived, and he gives you a journey through the symphony like nobody else. I mean, look, let's face it, without the Beethoven Ninth, there would have been no Bruckner. But no one else was able to take off from that piece in quite the same way. He responded to this by building these enormous cathedrals of sound and also cathedrals of harmonic logic and thought, because they are so powerfully put together. One of the things studying it hard is he realized that he had such a concept of what the architecture was that when he wrote the orchestral score out, what he first did was write all the lengths of the phrases. So underneath the bars, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, or 6 for a 6-bar phrase. And he would do the whole symphony like this. So actually, it was like building a floor plan of a cathedral. And one of the things with the Ninth Symphony, which he didn't manage to complete, is we do have some pages which have no notes at all, but have the phrase lengths on them. So he had this idea of where he was going, always, from start to finish.
You sense that too.
Absolutely. Without it, it would just completely, it would fall to pieces. And even within this floor plan, there is room for these almost enormous deep breaths of when actually the music stops and goes and begins on another journey. But it always remains in this incredible balance. And as I get older, it becomes more and more important to me. I must say, I think these are some of the greatest works of the Western canon.
Yes. Mahler, of course, is the composer that he is always linked with, although they couldn't be more different.
Well, isn't this always true? I mean, Haydn and Mozart,
yes, Ravel,
Brahms
and
Schumann. I mean, in a way, they're always from the same kind of period, but the differences are often so much more important than the similarities. I mean, it's the scale of Mahler and Bruckner that's simple, but you know, Mahler is such a person of detail and such a person of the most individual and neurotic temperament. And Bruckner is exactly the opposite. I mean, I've just been to Uluru for the first time in my life. And of course, Uluru is kind of a geographical Bruckner.
Yes.
You see it and you get this shock of the whole. And even what are all the individual little parts of it, these extraordinary caverns and shadows, they are obviously part of this great whole, and you get a feeling of something that is bigger than you are.
Mm. You're finishing up in Berlin and you're going to London, to the London Symphony Orchestra, and you're moving from one funding situation to a very different one. I believe Angela Merkel recently increased arts funding in Germany, but that doesn't seem very likely that that sort of thing is going to happen in the United Kingdom.
No, look, this is true. In Germany, there's always been the feeling that the arts are completely central to everything. I do remember in a city like Berlin, which our previous mayor said, well, you know, we're poor, but we're still sexy. And one of the things that makes Berlin sexy is the culture. And in fact, that's what people come there for. And there was always a feeling that that must be taken care of. England isn't a particularly rich country, but I mean, London is one of the wealth centres of the known universe. You know, you would think that there would be a kind of equal commitment to the arts. This is not always true, but so everybody is fighting, everybody is hand to mouth, but yet there are some of the greatest musicians on earth there, and some of the most extraordinary music anywhere being made. And so we just all have to fight our corner.
Yes.
But with 85 billionaires there, don't there have to be two or three who have a little bit of interest in the arts? And by sneezing, they could probably solve most of our problems.
Yes, they probably could. But I was thinking more of public funding. I mean, does it surprise you that some modern politicians question the very notion of public funding for the arts?
I mean, the fact that I think they are idiots doesn't mean that it surprises me. And I grew up with a generation of politicians who had a kind of hinterland. When I think of some of the guys from my youth or who I met later on, who were not only politicians, but who had an extraordinary background in all kinds of things, you know, who'd been through wartime and who maybe it's not surprising also that they realised the value of anything that helps the human spirit. It was a different time from the kind of career politicians who are crunching numbers. The smart ones realised that this is now desperately needed. I mean, actually, people who will listen to the businessmen who say, we need people who are culturally educated because the culturally educated people make the connections. Mm-hmm. We don't need worker bees anymore. We need people who can join other people together, who can see peripherally, who can be creative. This is all part of what's important. You know, and we lose arts and culture at our peril. I mean, one of the things that very much pleases me here is seeing, you know, how much more the indigenous culture here has seeped into people's consciousness, and that people are really learning from that, you know, you've got this extraordinary richness of a completely different philosophy of living and being, and that is now part of people's hinterland. And, you know, more power to your elbow, but we need all of these things, and if we lose this, we are impoverishing the human race.
You're listening to The Music Show on RN, and my guest is Sir Simon Rattle. In Berlin, and I'm quite sure in London when you get there, a very important part of your work with the orchestra has been the education side of things, getting the players working often with underprivileged children, with people who wouldn't necessarily be coming to your concerts. Do you have a philosophy of this? I mean, can you sort of sum it up for us, why you think it's important?
Look, it's really simple. Of course, I'm a musician. I'm biased. I think it's one of those human rights or needs, like the water we drink or the air we breathe. I think everybody needs to have this in their life, or they need to have the possibility of having it in their life, and we better get it across to them. It's as simple as that. For the people who say, oh, but isn't it just because you want to have a younger audience? I mean, if you think like that, you might as well give up from the start. You need, people deserve to have this in their life. Of course, it's not for everybody, but it can be for many people. And for some people, it will change their life. And for many people, it's just another extraordinary means of communication. So we better get it across. I mean, the London Symphony Orchestra were one of the first orchestras in the world who started a really broad but focused education plan. And this has been really part of their life. It wasn't something new to them, as it was in Berlin. And it's, for them, they've been working for now more than 30 years. And so I see how rich this is and how much they're bringing in the whole community. And when we worked there recently doing a wonderful community stroke children's opera by Jonathan Dove on the Minotaur. And I looked at all the performers and I thought, oh my God, this finally actually looks like London. Oh no, we have how many hundred nationalities do we have in London? And there they all were. A whole bunch of refugees, of course, who the story of the Minotaur and the kids being taken to be fed to the Minotaur and trying to find their families again. I mean, it has the most unbelievable resonance. These are all very, very important things. And it's not only that you get other people in there, it's that what all these other people give all of us. You know, when I say it's an education process, it's an education process for everybody, for all the musicians as well.
So you get something out of it
too? Oh, good God, yes.
Can you say what?
More understanding of the human condition. And also the fact that you have to talk to people about what you're doing and explain it more, that you are somehow more and more actually involved in your own art. And also, I mean, simply, I mean, it's a cliche, I know, but music is stories. Music is telling people about what it is to be a human being. And the more that goes in there from outside, the more that goes into the music. They're not divisible in that way.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about programming, because this is something which you've always been good at, putting things together in. And I remember a concert that you conducted a very long time ago in Liverpool, where you bookended it with Strauss, Don Juan,
the sandwiches, yes,
and the Metamorphose, and in between there were two Ravel pieces, and at the heart of it there was Et Expecto of Messiaen.
Exactly,
and that sort of approach to putting together a program where it's completely sort of unexpected, but sort of makes sense afterwards. In a way, that's sort of educational too, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, you don't want it to be too didactic and you don't want it to bash people on the head. But, you know, I love food. I mean, you know, you can probably look at me and tell that. And the idea of building menus is also important. You know, what flavours complement each other? What is it that you can do that will bring something else out? I don't know, it's some sort of, you know, composers are often very wide-ranging in everything they take from it. It's hard for us to imagine how much Bruckner loved Berlioz, for instance. You wouldn't imagine that there's any kind of French connection there. But the idea of this, the kind of short-breathed patience of Debussy as a counterpart to this long-breathed patience of Bruckner, for instance, is an interesting idea. But the idea that also you have only pork coupled with pork, this kind of old German cuisine where a vegetarian dish is a salad with not too much bacon in it. This is not always a good way to go. And for instance, recently we did a little tour of a piece by Helmut Lachenmann, I mean, who is a composer who I know, I mean, almost unplayed over here. But one of the greatest of the German composers who uses sounds from the orchestra that you wouldn't believe could possibly come from an orchestra. You think this must be electronic, this must be a machine. Very few normal notes, but yet you have an incredible emotional journey. And often it goes to the edges of silence that you can hardly hear. And the effect that this 10-minute piece had on the Mahler Symphony, because you realise a lot of Mahler Symphony is dust as well. A lot is at the limits of human hearing. And they seem to complement each other. And certainly the Lachenmann made the Mahler a different performance.
Hmm. Was it 9 that you did after the Lachenmann?
This was actually most recently, it was the second. With the 9th, of course, it is absolutely perfect. Hmm. Because the 9th is where words and... I know, as one older conductor said to me, you know, Simon, not all of this is music. Some of it is something other than music. And that's true. Lachenmann takes off from that point, but where it is still from a depth of human feeling.
You're listening to The Music Show. My guest is the conductor, Sir Simon Rattle. Can we perhaps finish by talking about Sibelius? I know you have been conducting Sibelius quite a lot recently, and Sibelius has been a really constant feature of your programming from your, you know, teens, I think, probably.
Well, my very first professional symphony concert had Sibelius V in it, and I must have conducted that probably more than any other piece.
So you've been doing it with the Berlin Philharmonic, and the Germans have often been a bit suspicious about Sibelius, in spite of the fact that he studied in Berlin. Are they overcoming this, do you think?
There was a time that, after the Second World War, there were some very influential philosophers, musicologists, particularly Adorno, who decided to make Sibelius the whipping boy for what music should not be. And one has to realise that they'd gone through this trauma of the Second World War and feeling that the music that was had led up to the political and racial and social catastrophe that they'd had. There was the feeling that anything that took from the old was to be avoided. Now, of course, Sibelius was always a different journey through Western music than music from Austria and Germany. But it has also an extraordinary logic and a sense of where it's going. But as he said, you know, I'm not one of those great old masters. I'm a wild sprite from the forest. And this can be hard for people there to understand. And if you haven't grown up with it, it takes longer. This is very clear. As a Brit, the music is so loved, and we never stopped playing it. So it's from my childhood. And if you're a timpanist like I was, of course, they're the greatest and strangest timpani parts ever written. But in Germany, what's interesting has been seeing them finally, even if unwillingly, come to it. People are saying, oh my God, no, this is great music. And this may not be our culture, but in another way, it has something. And of course, they have a kind of sound and a breadth of tone which can really help. A symphony like the Fourth, which is like Wagner's Parsifal, all this 4.5 hours taken and put in a trash compactor. So, you know, in 9 minutes, you get a whole lot of the journey of Parsifal in the first movement. Somehow, naturally, they can make that. What you can't get is this icy cold. This is not a blonde orchestra in any way. It's like, you know, the Gothenburg Orchestra would say, oh, we sound typically blondes, don't we? But you can get something else. And all great music can be played in many different ways. So it's been a huge pleasure working through it and seeing people come to it, hard though it is. You know, in my lifetime, for instance, you know, Bruckner as a kid was very little played in England. And I've watched musicians become more and more comfortable with it. And so now one has this immediate feeling. But to start off with, it was a matter of training people for what this was and to go for the long haul. And Sibelius, although it doesn't have this kind of mass, it has the mass of one of the white dwarf stars, where, you know, a teaspoonful would weigh more than the Earth, and a kind of white heat about it, which also takes training and learning. So it's been fascinating to revisit and give the Berlin Philharmonic once again, because Karajan was a great Sibelius supporter, give them once again these feathers on their coat.
It's a nice way of putting it. Sir Simon Rattle, thank you very much for being my guest on today's music show. Pleasure. That's one of the very earliest recordings that Sir Simon Rattle made, long before he was Sir Simon, with the Philharmonia Orchestra, the finale of Sibelius's Fifth Symphony. It's a piece that he's returned to over and over again. In fact, he conducted it in one of his first concerts with the London Symphony Orchestra. That was a conversation from 2015, when Simon Rattle was in Australia with the Australian World Orchestra. He's left the Berlin Philharmonic now, and their new conductor, the Russian-born chief conductor Kirill Petrenko, who's currently music director of the Bavarian State Opera. Sir Simon Rattle's final concert with the Berlin Philharmonic consisted of a single work, Gustav Mahler's Sixth Symphony, and as chance would have it, we'll be talking about that piece next weekend on The Music Show, because one of my guests will be Simone Young, and it's a work that she's about to conduct in Australia.